Today on Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Imagine having all of your data just gone and you have to pay money to get it back.
We are so excited. We have such a special guest here. He is the founder of one of the UK's largest cyber security firms.
A lot of these could be sanctioned groups operating in different countries, for example, in Russia or Iran, North Korea, that you're then funding terrorism or regimes, which is against sanctions.
And now has offices all around the world.
If you're a reputable organisation or you're handling sensitive government information, do you want to hire someone that has intentionally and knowingly broken the law?
Welcome, James Hadley, to Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Attackers are highly motivated to research continuously and employ the latest tools, so they're always going to be one step ahead. You can conduct cyber attacks kind of anonymously from anywhere in the world, and you can get payment anonymously through Bitcoin and digital currency, you've got this perfect storm. Thank you for having me.
We are so grateful for you to be here. We're going to get all into cybersecurity for the listeners and viewers that don't know really what that means. We all think we know what it means, but a lot of people don't really know what it means. I want to ask you, 2017, you've grown into one of the biggest cybersecurity companies in the UK with offices now all around the world. So we're talking, if my maths is right, 7 years. How on earth have you done it?
Your maths is wrong.
9 years, yeah.
Well, that's why I'm not in his chair. And that's why I've made my money out of hair. Talk me through how you started it.
I started immersive. My background was sort of IT geek growing up, played with computers because I didn't have any friends. Then joined the UK agencies in sort of central government and defence at 18, working in cybersecurity research. I did that for about 12 years. And then I had a career change opportunity to help lead and run the cyber school at GCHQ. It's government communication headquarters, so it's one of the intelligence agencies here in the UK.
Okay.
I had the opportunity to help lead that cyber school, and the purpose of that cyber school was to upskill talent that would go on to join UK PLC. And it was during that time I recognised that cybersecurity moves so quickly. The idea that you go to a kind of classroom and learn and you're done is kind of bonkers, because there's new threats every day, that are new techniques that are being employed by attackers. So I had the concept, rather than trying to upskill people in a classroom, what if we actually put people into real environments where they had to solve real cyber problems without instruction? So you target the outcome they need to achieve, but not how to get there. And in doing so, they apply analytical thinking, problem solving, troubleshooting, perseverance, curiosity, traits of a great cybersecurity defender. And in doing so, they upskill themselves. But the real benefit now is you can prove that person can do that thing. So you can measure the capability. And if you measure that across an entire business, across everyone's role, as it relates to their role in cybersecurity or even business functions and executives, you can now work out what the gaps are. And if you know what the gaps are, you know what the risks are. And that's the information that's valuable to our customers today.
Wow.
I think a lot of the children that fit the tech profile didn't have friends at school. When did you get friends and how did you deal with that?
Well, I think he was slightly joking, darling.
No, I want to ask that because I think it's very true.
I think I lived in the country as a young individual and there wasn't much going on, but I just fell in love with computers. I was sort of my ultra focus, hyper focus as it were. So I just enjoy computers, trying to break them, trying to put them together again, working out if you could try and get around software controls. It just had that inbuilt curiosity. And then ultimately I kind of did it as a hobby and then applied to that organisation when I was 18 and managed to start working in IT roles and then moved into cybersecurity quite quickly after that.
Just earlier you were talking about really your team. I mean, if you can monitor the team, then you can find out where the weaknesses are.
I think the best analogy I can give is every business in the world today, every organisation runs a fire drill to make sure people know how to get out, they can prove that all of that process works and people are safe. So immersive are running cyber drills. So we run exercises, simulations to see how teams and individuals respond. And then we can go, hang on, they did really well here, but actually this bit was a bit of a weakness and therefore we should try and improve that over the next 6 to 12 months. So when we run the next cyber drill, we can prove it's got better over time, prove readiness.
Talk me through your business model. Who employs immersive?
So we work with predominantly large enterprise customers, so Fortune 500 and government and defence departments. These are organisations that have a lot of assets to protect from cybersecurity threats. They're also probably under regulation and compliance in financial services sector especially. And we are working with those organisations to run simulations so we can benchmark how well they're doing in cybersecurity. What their skills are, what their knowledge, decision-making in a crisis, from non-technical rank and file employees to developers, cyber engineers all the way up to boards. So we go into some of the largest organisations in the world and we run tabletop exercises with their board to uncover what would they do in a ransomware
crisis.
So forget
the tutorials, the online tutorials, you're actually putting them to task. And I saw that you have the Ministry of Defence, HSBC, NHS, you've got a hell of a client list. Just quickly touching on AI, how do firms keep on top of AI?
There's two ends of the spectrum where organisations want to adopt AI, but they also need to put the controls around it to make sure it's used securely and safely. So the business wants to optimise, they want to be efficient, they want to be able to improve margins, they want to be able to bring in AI at speed. But the cybersecurity team in those organisations need to try and govern it and put compliance and controls around it in case it's used to attack the firm from the inside.
Wow.
So you've got this real tension between businesses and cybersecurity leaders about how do we enable businesses to adopt AI securely, because it's a new technology and new technology brings risks, unknown threats, unknown vulnerabilities. And at the same time, attackers are highly motivated to research continuously and employ the latest tools. So they're always going to be one step ahead because they can do it without any need for change control. I'm just going to try this, see if it works. Whereas companies can't really do that. And they're so busy doing their day job, our cybersecurity defenders across our customers, how would they have the time to then go and do 10 hours research on AI as well?
100%. I am Marks and Spencers, say a top FTSE 500, okay? Most of those companies have their own internal cybersecurity network, right? So what Immersive does is they might employ you to come along and find all the holes in it.
Not quite. So that would be penetration testing, which is widely adopted in the industry today. There are many firms offering those services. What we're doing is saying, hey, you're spending all of this money on people, technology and process. How do you know that if something was to happen tomorrow, unexpected, your team would be able to respond and recover? And how long would it take you? And how well would you do? And what decisions would you make? What would you tell the press?
And they're the exercises that you put them through, and that's why they have you in there to get to sort that out. And how often are you going in there? Do you go in every time and find that they haven't got it right and they're going to be floundering every time?
So we recently released a report from some research we did using the data in our platform. So everything that we do is through software, whereas traditionally it was delivered in person, face-to-face consultancy. So we're doing this through our software platform. And the data showed organisations believed they had a very high level of confidence that they would be able to do really well. But actually what we found was between 20 and 30% accuracy scores in how those exercises were achieved. And also the confidence in decision-making within senior business leaders was often misjudged or misplaced.
Can you insure a cybersecurity attack? Is there insurance for a cybersecurity?
Yeah, it's an absolutely booming market, especially over the last 5 years. So all the major insurers now offer cyber insurance. The premiums are going up and up because cyber attacks are increasing and becoming more impactful. And there are often a lot of terms around you need to have these controls in place in order to be able to claim on the policy. So it creates work both for the internal cybersecurity team, but also more increasingly, the budgets for cyber insurance are increasing.
Right. Checklist one, go and get insurance. As I was looking through the case studies, there was various different case studies, the oldest being Target, which is 150 million users' data, personal details, bank details taken. A lot of it was caused by supply chains. And actually, they're not targeting weak brands, they're targeting connected brands. Is that correct?
Yeah, so supply chain assurance is one of the hardest things to be able to measure and improve in cybersecurity, because if you're an organisation, your financial services organisation, or let's say you're a large manufacturer, you'll have thousands of suppliers. How do you prove that their security is good enough that when they connect to you, that they're not going to introduce a threat? So in the case of Target, I think that was actually they got through the heating and ventilation control network. So through the supplier that managed the heating and ventilation into the internal network. So they traversed the networks.
Wait, how did they do that?
So they managed to compromise the network that was running all of the heating and ventilation and air conditioning within the Target environment, which probably not a lot of people were focusing on from a cybersecurity perspective because it wasn't deemed to be sensitive, but because it was connected to the other networks within Target, they
could
go.
But they're not going to crawl through the ventilation system. What do you mean by that?
So all of the heating and ventilation systems are run by computers to measure the temperatures, set the configurations on networks. So they managed to get onto one network,
Right, they got into the server. Okay.
Yeah, a bit like getting in through a service elevator in a hotel maybe, you know, through the back door. There's a really interesting development in this sector now, which is organisations have traditionally sort of said, can you tick these boxes to become a supplier? You tick those boxes. But now increasingly organisations have to prove that their supplier would be able to recover as well. So not just have protection, but also recover, and then how they would work with that supplier.
But surely the supplier, they need to be insisting their suppliers have insurance.
Sometimes insurance might be mandated, but it mostly is more around what controls do you have to look after our data and stop your
incoming. You'd think it would be the internal team that was the major sort of attack, someone within the ranks. But actually it is. I mean, it seems across the board, the supply chain.
We must get on to, it's high profile cyber attacks that have happened recently. Jaguar Land Rover and Marks and Spencer's.
And Co-op, right?
Okay.
I loved that video.
So how on earth does that happen to two companies like that?
So I think in the past it was notoriety. It was, I managed to take down this bank or get into this environment or take this service offline. And attackers would often have their own handles, like their own sort of nicknames or usernames.
Scattered,
a bit like
spider.
Gaming. Yeah, exactly. Like Scattered Spider, a collection of young individuals working together. Now it's financial profit. So when these organisations are taken offline, they encrypt all of the data that belongs to the customer, all of their systems, render their business inoperable. And they say, hey, you can have all of this data back, and they extort them, and then we'll let you decrypt it because we have the decryption key. So imagine having all of your data just gone and you have to pay money to get it back.
Has anyone paid?
Yeah, ransomware payments are being paid a lot of the time. The UK have just introduced some legislation where if you pay ransomware, you have to notify the Information Commissioner's Office. A lot of the time it can be linked to sanctions as well, because a lot of these could be sanctioned groups operating in different countries, for example, in Russia or Iran, North Korea, that you're then funding terrorism or regimes, which is against sanctions. So there's a lot of, following a cyber attack, people assume it's the cybersecurity team that are responding. It's the whole business. It's the legal, general counsel, external counsel, press, media relations.
Let's talk about Marks and Spencer's and Jaguar and Co-op. How's that happened to them, James?
So unfortunately, defenders and organisations need to get it right every moment, every day, 365 days a year. Attackers need to get lucky once.
Yeah.
And in most of these scenarios, Scattered Spider weren't going, you know, using the most complex technical cyber mission, like, you know, like a missile straight through defences, like something out of James Bond. They were impersonating the service desk and then calling individuals and then convincing them to give them their password and then authenticating as those people. So from the cyber perspective, people were logging in normally. But because they'd compromised using social engineering, so I forgot my password, it's, you know, and yeah, this is John from the service desk. We're just doing some, can you give me your password? Then they could authenticate as legitimate users and from there go in, get access to more privileged accounts, watch what's happening, make sure they're being undetected, map all of the networks, get all of the data they can possibly download, including loyalty card schemes or anything like that. And then once they've done that, they render the network useless, they shut it down.
What is so shocking is, for instance, that TalkTalk where they got 150,000 bank card details. The ones that were arrested were 23, 21 and 17. And you just think, how are these kids so sophisticated at such a young age? Where are they coming from? Are they from particular countries? Is there particular countries that are breeding these? I mean, you touched on terrorism and I thought to myself, well, if I was a terrorist, then I would create a lab that would literally create these kids, these tech kids, bring them in, teach them everything they can to get the hacking skills up and then target particular global companies and make tons of money through that. Does that exist?
I think terrorism is often like not necessarily financially motivated. It's more like, you know, trying to create terror, hence the name. I think what we're seeing is there are more and more hackers being brought to justice who are teenagers and they're being arrested here in the UK. So a lot of when these firms were taken down, like Marks and Spencer, people were going, well, it must be Russia or it must be an external mega power. Mm. But actually it's teenagers banding together, you know, and working together, scattered, as it's all like anonymized, to achieve these outcomes. I think the reason it's happening at such a young age is there's a lot of synergies that are being seen around computer gaming. So when individuals come up, they're into computers, computer gaming, and they're tech natives. They know code, they know the network, they know the cloud, and they can put these things together. So it might start with, I want to cheat in a computer game, or I'm going to build a mod to get an advantage in a computer game. And from then, it's like that curiosity and trying to break in, like Rush, And then from there it can develop into more serious crime.
So is the government trying to put through legislation that basically says if you pay the hacker, you are then funding some form of terrorism?
Well, it just depends where the funding's going. So organisations, when they're negotiating, so you would negotiate with the attacker. You would go into a virtual chat room with the attacker and negotiate the ransom down. And because this is on the internet, there are great resources where you can see the conversation history between the business and the attacker.
And how many of them actually get all the data back after paying?
Many organisations assume that if they buy the decryption key, they'll be able to just go back to business the next day. But if you've got 50,000 workstations or old PCs in manufacturing plants, they probably all need to be physically revisited, rebuilt from scratch, then the data recovered. So the cost is not only the ransomware. The biggest cost for both Marks & Spencer and Django Lumre was lack of business revenue following it. So Marks & Spencer couldn't do any e-commerce because they couldn't bring back their e-commerce sites. They had to rebuild a new online shopping portal.
I mean, they were out of action for weeks. How did they get that back? And do you think they paid up?
I won't comment on whether I think they paid up. I don't know. Okay. Otherwise, I'd share it if it was public information. I think one of the challenges is, and I'm not a manufacturing expert, so this is kind of off the cuff, but there's a lot of talk about just-in-time logistics, just-in-time supply chain. The right part has to arrive at the right point to get the assembly build going. If all of those systems have been compromised, you've got to rebuild them. The way you bring them up, the order that you bring them up in, must be very complex. And then to have the staff to then have the right parts at the right time to then get the whole motor running must be very complex.
Marks & Spencer's and Land Rover, had they employed Immersive, could you have limited that, their comeback at least?
I think we would have exposed their current plans and policies and processes for what-if scenarios. So if you allow me, organisations before Immersive, and still some are today who don't use Immersive, they'll run tabletop exercises with their executive team. And a tabletop exercise is where you go, you've woken up, this has happened, what would we do next? And someone could say, we'd recover from backup. And they go, okay, how long would that take? And they go, oh, probably a week. Okay, next. Whereas with Immersive, they have to make a decision. And we actually look at the votes of the room of who would have voted for what option, i.e. to pay the ransom, not pay the ransom, how confident they are. But if they choose that decision, the crisis dynamically changes. It's a bit like a choose your own adventure book from the 80s, right? We had to turn to page 32 to find out what happened. So if they say, well, we'd recover from backup, our next inject could be, the backups are unavailable because the attackers deleted them. What do you do now? And suddenly it becomes, they have to live with the ramifications of their decisions through the crisis. You're going to pay the ransom. Great. How would you know it's legal for the countries you operate? And they're like, their mind sort of gets exposed. And then they realise, actually, we're not prepared at all. Or also, the things we've been preparing for might be the wrong things.
You need to make them take individual responsibility because it's individuals. It's the individual that will let it down. In 2003, I had an attack, a cyber attack on the first company we ever built. And it was coming out of Israel and Hong Kong. We happened by absolute luck, because we didn't know anything about tech. We had an in-house head of IT called at the time, who was an ex-Israeli protege. He was like a genius. He's now gone on to build his own company. He was an amazing, amazing kid at the time. He was young. He stayed up something like 48 hours fighting those two, and we won. They took our website, they took everything. We fought, we got it back. How do people find people like that to protect their company?
If we were doing this podcast 5 or 10 years ago, I would have talked about there's a huge shortage of these individuals, and we need to create more of them, and we need to upskill them using platforms like Immersive to help get them into jobs, which they can then go to help secure UK PLC. But what's happened over the last sort of, especially 4 years probably, is organisations are kind of replacing what they would call their level one security analyst, your first job in cyber, a bit like a help desk. Here's the threat. Is it an issue? Do I need to escalate this to someone else more technical? They're kind of replacing that with AI, because it's quite a repeated process job. They run 24/7. A lot of these security operation centres, like banks, et cetera, will have 24/7 security operation centres around the globe. And they'll have hundreds of people in them. The one thing I worry about, though, is it's a bit like, you know, when my dad, when I was young, he would always say fix his own car, because you could lift the bonnet, pull out a cable, try something, go and buy the parts. Now, if you open a car bonnet, it's a laptop port. So that you can't really upskill yourself. And I think the same might happen in cybersecurity. To be relevant, you need to have experience. You have to know about cloud, AI, coding. And we're expecting people to get their first job and know all of that and have experience, because we've replaced the level one and maybe two with AI. So I think AI is going to be a great advantage now. But in 5 years, I think we're going to have a real chasm of people that have the right skills for jobs. At the moment, there are more people that are certified and have degrees ready to go into cyber but can't get jobs because there are no job openings for entry-level cyber
roles. Is that why?
Because organisations are leveraging AI and software to help automate the people part of it. So the people who have got 5 to 10 years, they're in a really great spot. But as they move up through management jobs later, we're not going to have the next wave of
talent
coming in.
You're really looking to hire hackers, aren't you, as a business?
Because that's a very good point.
And we actually had a hacker that we didn't realise her, but this kid, he was a kid, skinniest little boy we've ever met, fantastic, smart. He was a hacker by trade, his past. And his hacker skills were gold standard. So surely you put a hacker against a hacker.
Yeah, but ultimately, if you're a reputable organisation or you're handling sensitive government information, do you want to hire someone that has intentionally and knowingly broken the law and therefore has a criminal record?
Well,
like
no,
that might go against HR policies.
Yes, but that wasn't the company that broke the law. The company is hopefully hiring someone that has the skills to go up against the people that break the law.
So I'll give you an example. So most organisations, they have two real focuses in their cyber team, the red team and the blue team. So the blue team are the defenders and might make up 90% of the team. They're the people monitoring the systems, installing cybersecurity software, writing processes, trying to keep the organised safe. The 10% might be the red team, and their job is to continuously try and break into the systems as if they were attackers. So their job is to test all of the systems to see if the blue team pick them up. And that might go as far as physical security. So we've had people in our team that used to work in red teams in the past. They help Immersive build our content for our customers. And they would, you know, wear a yellow jacket and, you know, cycle and follow a car into an underground car park at financial services and, you know, with a photo badge that looked just about good enough. And from there, go into the building, then try and get onto the network, then try and get access to data. And they could then go back to the bosses and say, this is what we managed to get, which means if we can do it, a hacker could do it.
Entrepreneurs Worldwide with Thompson Tindall.
What you've got with Thompson Tindall is a boutique, very specialised wealth management company and a company that I trust implicitly. And I've been with them 6 or 7 years and he has done wonders with my money.
Entrepreneurs Worldwide with Thompson Tindall. Getting a grip on family wealth protection.
Please note the value of your investments can go down as well as up, so you could get back less than you invested.
I want to ask you something that's very topical at the moment. Chinese embassy moving into the largest in Europe, and there's a whole hoo-ha about whether they should do it, because apparently, I read, there are certain cables, major networks running under the road, sort of carrying this, that and the other. Is that what the cloud is?
Yeah, it's infrastructure that runs all across the globe.
And, so a lot of people think it's all floating around up in the air.
Well, I guess you could say that is now, because obviously with Starlink, Elon Musk's company, there is a lot of satellite. I have it at home. Like, it's the quickest way to get internet in the countryside now is satellite internet. So that's going through the clouds. But all of that is landing back into infrastructure that is generally cabled together. And all of the world's internet traffic is carried together through cables, submarine cables.
That's what they were saying about the Chinese embassy moving in. I mean, how much of a threat is it? I mean, just because there's cables near the Chinese embassy and it's going to be so huge and all the rest of it, is that really a threat?
That wouldn't personally keep me awake at night, because the way... Yeah, it's a bit like driving your car from London to Edinburgh. There's many, many different routes you could take. So the likelihood of the bit of data you wanted being on that cable under a building that's not encrypted would be so...
So what are they worrying about?
Probably perceived threats. Okay. I think the thing about cybersecurity, it's all about risk, right? And if there's a risk which is high probability, it's going to happen and it's a high impact, you do something about it.
I think it's also about stripping the sensationalism or the... And actually make it very practical. So it's a top three signs of what you can look for as an employee within a company, that an employer can tell their people, if you see these three things happening, we are at risk, or the early stage of a cyber attack.
So it's changed over the years. So predominantly every organisation in the world today runs what is called mandatory security awareness training. And we've probably all done this in previous jobs, where you have to click the video and do a multiple choice quiz that says, I need a strong password, I have to keep my devices up to date. But really, that's ticking a compliance box. It doesn't measure if something happened. You got a phone call. You know, what would you do? How confident would you be? How would you report it? So that's why Immersive's different. We actually put people through those scenarios. So for example, we might have an exercise that we would send to thousands of people, 10,000 people. And it says, a journalist has called you, they got through to your extension, and they want to talk to you about information about your customers that's been found on the dark web. What do you do next? Do you talk to them? Do you put the phone down? Do you refer them to our security department? Okay, great. If you were going to raise that incident, who would you call? Who would you email? So when we can go back to our customers and say, well, we assessed and simulated through this drill 10,000 people, and it turns out 60% of your organisation has very little confidence in how to report an incident. So therefore, you might want to do something about that.
Or they're just easy to get information out of, which a lot of people are, if you push them.
Yeah, well, I think in the case of Marks and Spencer's, you know, journalists were going into the stores and going up to staff. And these individuals in the staff, they haven't had media training about no comment and what to say and how to deflect. And the organisation wouldn't be able to get comms out to their employees because they'd lost all their comms.
When we were regulators, we built a fund in Luxembourg and we had the police come in to our people. We sat them all around. And the police said, they ran them through a scenario and basically said, if you found out that this data or this information was being given to someone else, what would you do? And if you didn't say anything and you heard it, you are arrestable. You're basically, you're guilty of a crime. It was unbelievable to realise how many people really struggled with wanting to tell on their colleague. And I think that actually, listening to you, I'm thinking it should be mandatory for all these companies to run their people through some kind of security check as far as the human element of it.
I think it's the thing that we look for is decision-making and confidence. If people are making great decisions when faced with different scenarios, because there are hundreds of different cyber scenarios, it's about choosing the right ones. They make great decisions quickly with high levels of confidence. They don't need any training. Let them go back to their day job. But if you expose a part of the business which makes terrible decisions with high levels of confidence, that's a really bad combination. Yeah. And therefore, you want to go and treat that risk by upskilling those individuals.
100%. You talked about the dark web. What is it?
Everything that we use today is on the general what's called public internet. We go to our websites, we go and buy our food and our shopping, and our goods turn up online. But for cyber criminals that want to be anonymous, there's an anonymous internet within, like below, imagine an iceberg. So the internet is everything we can see, but below it is another internet underground. It's
That's
all connected.
Right.
And the way we get access to that is using special software.
Right.
And the information is encrypted through lots of different nodes. Like imagine hop, skip and a jump to get to the resource. So you don't know where the server is and the server doesn't know who you are as a customer. So it's totally anonymous, right? So you can conduct cyber attacks kind of anonymously from anywhere in the world. Mm. And you can get payment anonymized through Bitcoin and digital currency. You've got this perfect storm. Why would you ever do a physical robbery again if you can do it totally anonymously on the internet?
Is everything on the dark web naughty?
It's not always naughty. So it's really good for countries in certain regimes where internet sites might be blocked for them to get access to media and information. So, for example, Wikipedia might be an amazing resource, but blocked in certain countries because it might promote Western democracy. So if you're in those regimes, you can use the dark web to access a dark web version of that website. So they replicate the content. The BBC has services that can be accessed through the dark web, so you can get access to BBC News. So there are legitimate reasons to have it. Unfortunately, the majority of people that are leveraging it are likely to be trying to do something more sinister.
Let's say there is a cybercrime attack that happens tomorrow to a major brand. What are the number one three things they can do immediately that will stem the flow of the attack?
So it's so hard to have playbooks of if this happens, you should do this, because it isn't a cyber crisis. It's a business crisis that stemmed from a cyber incident. A lot of it might be, taking services offline. So if you've got an attack on your network and they know they're encrypting your data, by turning everything off, it stops them in their tracks. Also means that you can't do business. So you need a way of recovering and stepping everything up and checking it's all secure to get back to business as usual.
Years ago, my first job was working for Garrard's of Queen's Jewellers in Regent Street. And downstairs, they had all the clients' details in a vault and just written down. Would it be prudent to say that in the cyber world today that actually there should be a vault with all the clients' details written down?
It's a very, very good point.
We've got a partner we're working with at the moment, which we offer a service to customers called our Cyber Bunker. It's like a shadow headquarters. So it's a completely separate service which is ready to go. It's like your safe room, you know, in a house, like a metal room. And it has in there the ability to communicate securely, the ability to do video conferencing, access all of your files, your credentials, things like all of your business plans, your processes. So in the event that your main headquarters, like Marks and Spencer's, down, a lot of organisations today, the executive team would then communicate on WhatsApp because they've lost email. And that's got no system of record and what have you. So immersive offering enables our customers to then come into our cyber bunker and then communicate, manage the incident, collaborate, build up an audit record for the insurer, and then report back to the regulator.
And where is your cyber bunker?
It's in the cloud.
Well, how is that safe then?
It's built very, very securely with multiple layers of security and multi-factor authentication. I think the likelihood of it would be a very bad day if you're a company and you got compromised at the same day, another cloud operator got compromised at the same time. That's like a low likelihood.
James, let's just leave cyber security to the side for 1 minute. You, in your own words, were a natural geek.
Yes.
Let's talk about how you built that company.
We're going into companies that have already invested a lot in cybersecurity and now they want proof that everything they're doing is working effectively. How do we prove that our teams have the knowledge, skills and judgment to keep
us
safe?
But how do you charge?
It's a subscription to our platform.
Okay.
People pay annually in advance. A lot of these transformation programs are multiple years. So a lot of our customers will sign up for 3 years. So year one, they'll focus on how do we upskill the technical teams, year two, the business teams, year three, the AI teams.
But with my entrepreneurs and business hat on, if I'm paying a yearly subscription and I haven't been hacked, I start thinking, do I need to pay him every year to do this?
So the real value for our customers is insights and data. So yes, we have 3,000 of these exercises, simulations built by the world's best cyber experts here in the UK that have come out of intelligence and defence. So that would traditionally have been our sort of moat as a business. Yeah, you get access to all this content. But the value for the buyer, if I'm the chief security officer of a bank, is I've got a report that proves our capability that is tested every 3 months. I can show where it stacks ranks to my peers in financial services. I can present that to my insurers, my regulators and my board.
Brilliant.
So that when they say, hey, this was in the news today, would we get hit? They go, well, we tested for that 3 months ago with Immersive and we came out on
brilliant.
Top.
Probably their biggest risk is actually the person that's heading up cybersecurity department.
No, you're right. And I think 10 years ago, Immersive wouldn't have succeeded. Most security officers at the time were from a very technical, geeky background. Mm-hmm. I know best. Mm-hmm. I'm a cyber geek. You know, no one can hack my network. Now, if you're a chief security officer of a large organization, you're a business leader and you understand business risk and financial risk and compliance and regulation. So anything that helps you prove your capability, but also identify gaps is kind of a no-brainer. So I think that's why Immersive is probably doing better. It exists today and not 10 years ago because people want to understand.
You've transitioned from being this unbelievably intelligent, incredible techie guy to running a team and building a business.
So I think it was a perfect storm. So it's about 2016, 2015, one of my really, really good friends, he started a cybersecurity business. And he became a founder and I was, oh, that's exciting. And I was kind of helping a bit from the sidelines and like, you know, wanting to invest and wanting to be on that journey. And he was developing software using AI. And actually, if he'd started his company now, it would have been like the perfect time, but it was a bit too new, sort of 11, 12 years ago. People are like, AI, it's not going to take off. And I watched him do it and I watched him get investment and start a board and hire people and get customers and do R&D. And I was like, that's so fascinating. So that it opened my eyes to this is a route. At the same time, I had this idea for the software, like, hang on, we can't train people in classrooms. It doesn't prove they know anything. How do we measure to understand what the gaps are? And I kept toying with the idea. And I think I presented it to a few people and they, oh, that'll never work. That'll never take off. And I just got more and more angry. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to prove everyone wrong. So it was more out of sheer spite that I had this blueprint from my friend that had started his company.
Stubbornness.
I know, I'm just going to prove myself. And I did work very, very hard in the early years. It was long, long weeks, long hours, because I was coding the platform and running the business at the same time.
Of course.
And then we were very fortunate that we got Goldman Sachs as an early customer.
Did you?
They subsequently invested about $8 million into this shipping container company in Bristol. You know, we were in a shipping container at the time. And from then, it was a fantastic experience because we grew. That enabled me to hire amazing people that are much better than what I don't code or do anything like all my code's been thrown in the bin because we have proper engineers, proper cyber teams, proper salespeople. And now we have a global organization of 300 people.
What does James Hadley's day look like?
Yeah, well, for the first 8 years of the business, I was founder and CEO. It's quite a lonely position as a solo founder because you've got no one, you can't tell your team it's bad. You can't tell your board or your investors. So you kind of struggle. I was very fortunate to have a peer group of other cyber founders in the UK that were ahead of me on their journey. They were my backbone.
And they helped you.
They were amazing. If it wasn't for those people, I think I would have really struggled. So Dave Palmer, he was one of the founders of Darktrace, which is one of the UK's, the most successful UK company. I think they exited to Thoma Bravo for $5 billion in a take private. So he was one of the founders of that company. He's been a great mentor to me. Al Patterson, he started a company that was in 2015 that got bought by a big American company. He's now doing his second cyber startup. So this network of UK cyber founders, we all kind of look after each other. And it's a great ecosystem. So I was founder and CEO for 8 years. And then after about 8.5 years, you know, I was like, this is getting... It's becoming more about running and execution than it is about new ideas and creating software.
Of course.
So we built 6 products in our platform. I thought, I really love spending time with customers. I love coming up with new product ideas. I love spending time with partners, going to events. I don't enjoy looking at spreadsheets of financial data and quota attainment rates or, you know, hit rates for marketing leads to conversion to sales qualified leads. It's just not my skill set. So I approached the board and said, I think this is now the right time that we start a search for a CEO, and I move into the Chief of Innovation Officer role. So I ran that search for about 4 months. I was quite fussy because it's my baby. And then I was very fortunate to meet Mark Schmitz, who's now the CEO of Immersive, who's based in Atlanta.
To be a CEO, some people will sit in that chair and say, actually, I can be a CEO of anything. I've been a CEO of lots of different companies. I'm struggling to see how you can be a CEO of a cyber crime company unless you've got that kind of experience.
No, I think it works because Mark and I are a team. I'm still the founder of the business. I'm still a full-time executive. Mark was previously like CEO, you know, he's a company of Ariba that got bought by SAP. He's run large software companies. He was the interim CEO of Citrix that sold for like $16 billion.
So he has an understanding of that world.
He knows enterprise software.
Okay.
He knows how to run a global organization, how to run sales, go to market, all of that. Yeah. That's not my strong point. I was always more on the technical side. And I get to do all the things that I'm good at, which is cyber. Whereas I think if I'd hired a cyber CEO, there wouldn't be a need for me anymore.
James. How easy is it being to scale?
I'll tell the same story I tell everyone, which is in the first year, you have good days and bad days. In your second year, you have good weeks and bad years. Your third year, you have good months and bad months. In your fourth year, you have good quarters and bad quarters. And then you have good years and bad years.
Incredible.
So some years are tough. Some markets can be good, new ventures, products. And other times there are challenges. A lot of those might be with people or leadership changes. As the company matures, you often need to bring in new leaders who can get you to the next scale. And that creates challenges with friendships or individuals you've known for that time. So I think that's one of the biggest, I wish I could go back and do again kind of thing. That when you hire people, you say, hey, just let you know, like, you're great at this, but at some point, if we don't scale, we're going to need to bring in someone and have
that. What are you saying that you say, yeah, I wish I could go back? Are you saying that you haven't had that conversation with them at the start?
Yeah, kind of. I think when you start together as a merry band of friends, you assume that you're all going to go through the whole journey together. But, you know, if people were staying in their job at the speed we were scaling, they were doing an amazing job. But they weren't going to get probably the next job up because you need experience. Yeah. And over the years, we've brought in executives that have run companies. Our HR officer was number 2 at Google for 12 years. Like these are world-class executives, which means that they just run those functions. They don't need direction. They are just business leaders. And that's what helped Immersive scale to where it is today.
Yeah, I think the CFO is probably the pivotal role in that evolution. Part of the reason we started Entrepreneurs Worldwide is because there is such a misconception about entrepreneurs in the wider public view. And I have a deep passion of entrepreneurs. I absolutely love them. I think they are some of the kindest, nicest, most unmoney driven, interestingly, people that countries need and public do not understand. Because I actually find Joe Bloggs a lot greedier than any entrepreneur I ever meet.
I think it's a good question. I think I'm going to link it back to your question, which is like, how did you find out about entrepreneurs? It was because friends started a company. I was actually always self-employed, so I knew a little bit about running a business.
Do you see yourself as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I think entrepreneurs generally are quite driven, relentless in the pursuit of achieving their goals. Yeah, they'll run through walls, they'll work 20 hours a day, you know. So I think I would see myself as an entrepreneur. But I don't remember being at school and people talking about entrepreneurship. It was like you had to do the test and it'll tell you what your ideal job is. No, I don't think one of them was go and start a business, fail, then start another, then start another.
Did you have a role model of your parents, entrepreneurs, successful?
No, neither. They both worked in full-time employment. My mum worked in travel, my dad worked in law.
If James Hadley hadn't started Immersive, what would your career have looked like?
God, I dread to think. I think I changed jobs probably, like, or roles within teams probably every 2 or 3
something
years.
Something techie, though. Always techie. Would have been techie.
I don't think so. Only the reason I started techie at young, but as I got older and I started like having a team or running a team, it's more about managing the team. It's less about the hands-on skills. I think it was because I'd gone back to become like a teacher. I had to relearn those tech skills at like 33, 34 years old and got back into it. Mm-hmm. That was enough to get me to the proof of concept with immersive before real developers could come in and take it over and scale. So I don't think it would be technical. I really enjoyed being a teacher or instructor. Like, I loved seeing the light bulb moment. You know, when we had individuals at the cyber school, the best talent were the ones that had degrees in ethical hacking from university. They were the ones at 8 o'clock at night that would still be there going, but why, when I did this, did it have this outcome? I need to know why. And if they knew why, these people that didn't have a technical background day one, because we used to run it for 10 weeks, Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, they would be there at week 7, 8, and they would achieve amazing things.
Dyslexic children are very high problem solvers. I know that 50% of NASA go for children with history of dyslexia because they have a higher propensity for solving problems and spatial awareness.
I just want to ask you, do you know what your exit looks like?
I think at the moment the company's got to a certain model of like repeatable and predictable revenue, because that takes a long time to get to. We had this many customers, we know all this take this long, this is how we service those customers. So I've almost got a bit of a new lease of life now that Mark's come in and some of the weight's been removed on day-to-day operations, and I get to do the bits I love. I wouldn't want that to end anytime soon. You know, my nirvana was in a world where there's only over 3,000 venture-backed cyber companies in the industry. Over 3,000 venture-backed, all trying to sell to the same person, trying to get above the noise is a challenge, right? Because there's only so much that people can remember in sold to all day. So one of my nirvana moments is when we could say, yeah, the entire Fortune 500 use immersive. That would be a nice milestone to go, yeah, we kind of conquered it, we've done it.
Wow, so you're hanging around for a little bit longer.
Yeah, that's definitely. I think if you're having fun, the culture of the organization's still good and the values are still being respected that we instilled at the start, and you're growing, why would you want the journey to end?
You've got 300 employees,
yeah,
which is absolutely incredible. In 9 years, how many offices around the world do you have now?
So we have people working all over the globe because of post-COVID, you have a remote workforce. Yeah. But our main hub locations are Bristol in the UK, where I started the business. We've got Boston in the US. We've got a team out in the Middle East based in Dubai that serve the entire Metna region, Australia and Germany.
Are you on death row?
Not hungry. I'm not hungry.
You weren't shocked there.
Yeah.
Yes. What's your last meal?
I think it would be too obvious to say a really like medium or very rare fillet steak, something like that.
Say what you want.
There you go.
Some people come here and say shepherd's pie.
A lot of people come here and say
I'm on Ozempic and actually I'm still not hungry.
I'll tell you a story someone told me. So we were talking about, we've just moved slightly outside of our town, which means we can't get delivery of food, like Deliveroo and stuff. And we're like, oh, Mr. Zosis. I was talking to a friend of mine and he said, they asked himself a question before they ever ordered Deliveroo. Because people have this vision of nice food, but it's actually slop in a plastic container. Will it be better than baked beans on toast with cheese on top? And the answer is no, they have baked beans on toast. So maybe the answer should be baked beans on toast with grated cheese on top, because it's such a comfort food.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yes, absolutely. Brilliant. Awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Well done. James Hadley, founder of Immersive. We have loved this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.